Welcome to our Riddle Friends podcast. This is the first ever episode. We hope to offer this four times a year as an accompaniment to our print magazine. In this episode, we're talking to Lisa Moore at The Rooms. We're talking to our contest winner, Joshua Gowdy. And we're talking to one of our brand new reviewers, Xavier Michael Campbell.
Hi, this is Lisa Moore.
My name is Joshua Gowdy.
I am Xavier Michael Campbell.
Welcome to the Riddle Fence Podcast.
Hi, this is Lisa Moore, checking her volume.
That's perfect.
I'm Annie Bowman, and I'm here with celebrated author, local author Lisa Moore. You've written a piece for us, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your piece and just a little bit about your experience in the past writing different things for Riddle Fence.
I wrote about Stan Draglin. He was a friend, and he's recently died, and he was such a massive force. And if you want to speak about joy, he was a man full of joy. He was a maker of things. He was a writer. He collected sentences, beautiful, what he thought were beautiful sentences, a bricolore.
Sculpture. I wish I could see some of his sculptures. That's,
yes, there should be a show for sure. And just a very kind-hearted, lovely man. And I just wanted to say what I felt about him.
Yeah. And how many times have you been published in Riddle Fence?
I actually think that might be
your first time.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's very cool. Hopefully not the last.
No. Yeah. I'm already thinking in my head, I'm going to send them something else. It worked out so well the first time.
You totally should, yes. And Lisa, tell me what we're doing here today at The Rooms.
Well, we're at The Rooms, Andy. And first of all, thank you so much for chatting. We're at The Rooms because it's the final day of a conference that was hosted by Memorial University English Department and the University of Grenoble Alpes about the aesthetics of contamination. And so it really is about the environment, oceans in particular, and movement. So like movement of materials, and it's about pollution, but in terms of art, as we're interpreting it today here in The Rooms, it's about media, like switching, like multimedia, I guess, and allowing different media to inform each other. Well, I think it was, you know, the conference is really about both. It's research creation. So it's about how research informs creation and how creation informs research. And the truth is that universities have always held artistic practices, and artists have always researched their work. But there's this kind of artificial division between the two. We did have a panel. Well, to start where we came from, Nancy and Andre, Nancy Pedri and Andre Dodeman, they had a conference in France, and I was invited to that to speak about my novel February. And everybody was talking about oceans there, but like from many different disciplines, from history, from geography, from like talking about communication, talking about trade routes, all that stuff. So because the Alps, the University of Grenoble Alps and MUN have a partnership, we did the sister event here. We did include people who are scientists, of course. And that was very interesting because one of the things that came up was, you know, what happens when industry is paying for research, and what kind of censorship there is around that. Yeah. And that came up, and also just the idea that the universities are silos, like they're, you know, and like why are sciences and arts separated to begin with? I think artists for a long time have been working on stuff that has to do with science. And I suggested in a question period that maybe it's time for the scientists to make art. And of course, as I already said, those definitions are ridiculous because we're all doing that always.
There's an author I really like, Bill McKinnon, and he wrote in The New Yorker a couple of years ago that where are the climate change poems, where are the climate change plays? We're not recording this moment. Did you notice an inertia when it came to art about the climate or art about oceans? Or do you think that sort of art has always been there?
I don't know if it's always been there, but you know, perhaps like my novel February, for instance, is about oil production. And I didn't think of it when I wrote it as a climate crisis novel.
I didn't either. I read it, you know, when it came out and thought it was a book about grief. And I reread it recently and I was like, oh, this is about oil extraction.
And so it is about oil extraction. But I think there are tons of works that can be reread in this moment, and are being reread in this moment, that are definitely about climate crisis. But I don't know if we really could have seen the moment that we're in as clearly as we do now while we're living it at that time. I'm not sure. I'm sure many people did see it, but not everybody. And I think there's an explosion of work about climate crisis in the academy and also through our communities.
Also, I wanted to ask you, you've had a busy fall. Mm-hmm. You've had some wild translations of your work and new things happening. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yes, well, I worked for 2.5 years with a composer named Laura Kaminsky and with Opera on the Avalon under the direction of Cheryl Hickman on a production opera of February, my novel February. It was a project that was beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, it was it moved me in so many ways. I guess it's so many people coming together to make something over an extended period. I think it was 2.5 years, close to 3, that we worked on this. And just seeing all the moving parts and understanding that these singers, like the incredible instrument their voice is, and what they give over and over and over again in performances all over North America and Europe of operas, you know, I found it incredibly moving. And when I listened, I felt the ephemerality of us as humans. But when I mentioned that to Gretchen, the choreographer, I said, bodies are ephemeral. And she said, they're not any more ephemeral than this table. Or, you know, like, why do we say bodies are ephemeral? And of course, in some ways, yes, we die. But I mean, the world is we're a part of the world.
Yeah.
And we're no more or less ephemeral than all of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm thinking about that just made me think off in a different tangent about how a lot of us are not living in our bodies or not experiencing our bodies. We're more in our heads. We almost feel like those are separate things. I don't know if that's been your experience, but an opera is such a visceral thing. Mm-hmm. It's something that people on stage are doing their whole. Mm-hmm. All of them.
And it's very poignant because it's about breathing and we're living in a world that's being deprived of oxygen. So, I mean, I sat through many rehearsals of various different kinds. And sometimes I would be thinking things like, oh, if she flicked her hair, you know, then that would be good. I mean, not that basic, but you know, like thinking about how the production was coming together. And other times, unexpectedly, like I was just punched in the gut and actually felt it in my chest bone, mostly because I could feel the vibration of their voices. And so there was no way to avoid the power of the human voice and breath, because those opera singers sustain those notes for so long. And that is their craft, yeah. Or they can. I mean, anyway, it was just beautiful.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such an amazing thing. What else are you doing this fall?
Well, I'm writing a book along with a man who Jack Whalen, who as a child was in the Whitburn Boys Home and was kept in solitary confinement from the ages of 13 to 17 for a total of approximately 2 years, sometimes for a length of 3 months, without books, without natural light, without conversation, without contact with his family. He was 13, he was 14, he was 15, up until he was 17. Every time he ran away, several times, over 20 times, and you know, nearly froze to death. And later, a boy ran from that home and did freeze to death. So we're writing that story together, and it's
does Jack have a truck?
He does. Yeah.
Okay.
So he built a replica of the cell that he was kept in. And he built it outside his mother's home, what had been his mother's home. His family still lived there. And, you know, we've been working on this book for 2 years. And the horror of being kept in that cell also repeatedly hits me as I write this book with him. We're co-authors. But I just, the power of him building that cell, he just wanted to get back to his family. So like he would run, he was chased by dogs, police dogs, he was chased by helicopters, he was, you know, he'd hitchhike to the highway and just get into St. John so he could see his family. And the fact that as a 64-year-old man, he's built the cell, a replica of the exact dimensions of the cell, which is not really long enough to stretch your legs. Like his legs, I mean, not really. His legs were cramped from being in there because there was no room to exercise, you know, when he was a child. And the fact that he built it, like, just because that's where the most convenient place to build it, but the cell was moved to his family. And of course, he drove it all across Canada to Ottawa because he's trying to fight the statute of limitations against child physical abuse. Because in just two provinces in Canada, you cannot sue the government for child abuse after the 10 years after the age of 19, unless it's sexual abuse.
But, very convenient law that the government has.
Yes. And so actually we have been, Jack and I, well, mostly Jack and his family, but when I can, I have gone to the House of Assembly with him. He was there every day while he was here. He presented petitions that were signed. He had 600 names in Newfoundland, 400 across Canada, which don't count at the provincial House of Assembly. And just asking the government to take away the law, which he will, if they don't do it, he'll have to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. And my sister is fighting that law as well because she had a class action suit against Whitburn. So I hope that the government, if you're listening, repeals that stupid law.
They almost definitely aren't, but we'll do what we can. I'm so sorry. But it's amazing. That's amazing work you're doing. And I have seen Jack's truck and have honked and have wanted to know more. So that's excellent that you're writing a book about that with Jack. And when can people expect to see that book?
In the fall of 2024 with Knopf Canada.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll keep an eye out for that. And it's so funny because when I pitched this podcast to Elizabeth and Carmela at Riddlefence, they were like, keep it fun. You and I have not done that, but it's impossible. It's impossible.
Dang.
The world is hard. Yeah, it's a world, hard world out there.
Well, okay, let me just try.
Yeah, no problem.
I mean,
they shouldn't have sent me to do it. I'm the wrong person.
Well, all you said was, what are you working on? Yeah. My fault. No. I'm the wrong person.
No.
But the dance that's happening here today is so joyous and so beautiful. And it's the bringing together of people who often didn't know each other, and to do something spontaneous and joyful. And It's sunny out. I think that's the best I can do for you, Andy.
Well, you know what? I also think there's something joyful about sharing stories. And so giving platform to Jack's voice and to the ongoing lawsuit, there's something joyful about that. I'll make that case.
Yes, I agree.
I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day. I know it's really busy. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Andy. I really appreciate the interview.
My name is Joshua Gowdy. I'm a writer living in St. John's. Most of my published work so far has been children's books, but I do have just a real love of literary fiction. I've been working on a few projects over the years. And this story came out of taking Lisa Moore's short fiction class last fall. We had a project based on writing a piece that was evoked by tasting something. So we had that sort of Proust Madeleine's pitch where we go home, eat something, and come up with a story. And the story that I wound up winning with evolved out of something that I wrote for that class.
It's not to give too much away to listeners, praying that we have some, I found it really interesting that you wrote in the female voice. Have you done that before?
Yeah, most of the time I find when I'm writing particularly literary fiction for children, I try to go back and forth and mix things up as much as I can. But when I'm writing for adults, I do tend to write from a female perspective. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that growing up, I had a lot of very strong female voices that sort of shaped my life, and I like drawing inspiration from them. I think that was sort of the first time that I became interested in telling my own stories, was from just being upstairs as a little boy listening to my mother's weekly art groups. A bunch of women would get together and paint and tell stories together, and I think that really shaped who I am as a storyteller.
Let's talk a little bit about your process. It's a Wednesday. How much writing do you do in an ideal world?
In an ideal world, I try to carve out 3-hour blocks because I can't, I've learned this about myself. I can't really write more than 3 hours at a time unless I have unless it's 3 hours in the morning, take a giant break and then maybe come back in the evening. And if I don't have 3 hours, I don't start because I just get really frustrated because I know I can't really get moving. The process is, I always think about, for anyone who knows Calvin and Hobbes, there's a Bill Watterson cartoon. It just says the creative process, and it's just an image of him with his just slack-jawed tongue hanging out of his mouth, staring straight ahead. And I've always loved that because it's just so honest. So much of your time is just spent sitting there in your own head and your own thoughts. I guess it depends on what stage the story is at. I think that's a lot of the writing is just hoping for an idea to come and then doing your best to capture it. Editing is a bit different for me because I usually just take a section and just pour over it over and over and over it, and then sort of try to find a story in all of the words I've come up with thus far.
You mentioned you were taking a class. Are you currently doing a master's or a PhD, or is that just for personal development?
Just for personal development. I don't know that I have the... I think I could go back to school, but I don't know that I want to.
This is the exact thought process I've had, where I've been like, sometimes I feel like I should go back to school, but like, would I just be better off chugging? Keep chugging?
Yeah, and I think just dipping in, maybe finding a class is a good way to do things. But I thought about it similar to, you know, doing a writer's retreat. I've done things like that in the past before. I think it's good to every now and then just get out of your space where you're working, go do something else with some other people, because I think so much of what we do is done alone. I mean, you know,
it's so lonely.
You're just locked in your room hoping that something is coming from what you're doing. And it is really good to get out in the world and sort of show people, this is what I'm working on. Because one, it's healthy, and two, it can often be really validating and give you the fuel to keep going.
What about feelings of competitiveness? Like, I feel like all writers get that. What do you do?
I used to be really competitive. When I first started writing, I was incredibly competitive, and to the point that if I didn't get a grant, I would go on the Arts Council website and just look to see who else was who had gotten grant funding, and I would, you know, sort of study what their project was, put it in the back of my mind. When the book came out, I would get the book, read it, and think, okay, this is what the market wants. This is what people want to see. So that's, and really try to write in that way. I've learned over the years that that's not a good approach, because I very early on in my career, I was trying to write like people who were doing very well at that particular time. So I remember when, I think Joel Thomas Hines had just had his second book come out. I devoured that, read it a whole bunch of times. I thought,
we shall all be burned in our beds.
No, I think that was the third one. The second one was Say Nothing, Saw Wood.
Oh,
and
yes.
Before that, he had been, you know, Down to the Dirt had come out, and that was, and I, you know, just poured over both of those books and thought, okay, this is what a Newfoundland author needs to sound like, because this is what's, you know,
selling
doing
it
well right now. And so I was just doing a bad Joel, you know, and no one wants to read that, because Joel's already out there doing that. He's telling his stories, and I really, it took a long time of trying to write like other writers, you know, when Galore came out, oh, this is how to write. So now I'm going to try to do a bad Michael Crummy. And I did. I did a really bad Michael Crummy. But it was only after really studying the way that other writers work, I think, that I found my own voice. And I'm kind of okay with that now. I'm, you know, if you go to, you know, famous museums, you go to like Tate Modern or something, or the Borghese Museum, you'll see artists sitting down in front of masterpieces just trying to recreate what someone's done before them. They're trying to find their own voice by studying other people. And I'm kind of okay with that's how I've got to the point where I think I'm telling stories worth hearing now.
Okay, I got really paranoid because I thought this wasn't recording. podcasts, you're a work in progress, but we're good. But I'm really curious, like, what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm trying to finish up a manuscript that I've been working on for years and years and years. It's something that I've had moments of success with. A few years ago, I won the Percy Jane's First Novel Award, and I kind of feel like that's a good sign that you're done. I'm someone who's very, has a lot of problems in agreeing that a work is finished. I know there's that old story about, was it Paul Cézanne? Like, so many of his paintings are out in the world and they're not, they have no signature because he died just refusing to put them out because he didn't think they were finished. And everyone else has said, no, it's done. We're putting it on the wall with or without you. And I think now I'm at the point where I really need to just get rid of this and move on to something else.
Are you currently signed with a publisher, or are you sort of free agent, like flying back and forth, publish whichever way you want?
So my kids' books are all with Breakwater, and they have expressed interest in the novel manuscript as well, but I need to accept that it's done before anyone.
Okay.
And I mean, maybe they see the finished product and think, no, this isn't for us. And that's perfectly fair too. So,
yeah. It's
hard. See what happens.
Yeah, it's the business part that you're like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, the business side of it is very much my Achilles heel. I've been trying for a long time to find representation and, you know, find an agent who can sort of be the sort of guiding light to help me, I guess, one, accept when things are done, and two, point me in the right direction of here's where we might think of going next, because I know that I like to think that I'm good at telling the stories. I don't know that I'm great at knowing what to do with them once they're out.
I just want to talk to you a little bit about reviewing. You're one of our reviewers now, which is awesome. Tell me what you've seen, what you're going to see, and just sort of the mindset you're going into it with, because reviewing things is wild.
Yeah, it is. Hi, I'm Xavier Michael Campbell. I am a writer living in St. John's, Newfoundland. And I think about when, you know, any of my writing gets reviewed, and it's like kind of crazy. And it's now, so I think I'm going into it with that frame of mind of like, I've had my work critiqued before. So let me try and be as generous as I would like someone to be with my work, and to have like as much care as I would expect someone to handle my work. Because, you know, putting your art out there for people is very nerve-wracking and very vulnerable. It's like, it's a lot. So I think I go in it with that frame of mind. So I've seen I've seen some shows with, and done some workshop with the Festival of New Dance so far, which were like everything I did was and saw was fantastic. And I'm just like blown away by the art that is being produced and like that is available for people to bear witness to in the province. It's amazing. And I'm so glad that I get to be a part of it and to like try and get other people like amped about it and like want to come and see. So the plans to see a couple of films in Fogfest. So I'm pretty excited about the Hag premiere because, you know, I love folklore and I love stories about the old hags. So I'm very intrigued by this, as well as some Atlantic shorts. So it should be gory, quick, but chilling films. I'm hopeful to go and check out some exhibits at Eastern Edge and write about that. There's Megan's show, and that's being shown, exhibited right now until December. So I'm excited to go and check that out. And yeah, I'm just like thrilled to get my hand on, you know, the pulse of the arts community more. Like yeah. Writing is so solitary, but this reviewing really gives me a chance to go out there more, go and engage with other artists and interact with more people and just like see how other people are taking in the work. So, my new exciting project would be my new book co-authored with the local journalist, CBC journalist Heather Barrett. The book is called Black Harbor. It's about the lives of free and enslaved Black people in early Newfoundland and Labrador.
I can't even imagine the undertaking, the research. Where did you start?
It's a funny story, I guess. Because I am primarily a fiction writer, and I'm Jamaican born. I've been living in Newfoundland for over a decade now. So I guess I would say I started trying to think of some of the stories that hadn't been told about ways that Jamaica and Newfoundland may have connected historically. Things that weren't really talked about as much or stories that were largely forgotten. So just looking at that to think of what characters could be formed, what like plot lines could come up that could possibly inform a historical fiction narrative. And through doing like research here and there, like different subject matters, especially like following the cod and sugarcane and byproducts of sugarcane, I met up with Heather Barrett, who was also doing research into colonialism and slavery and Newfoundland as a colonial empire at one point, as like a colony of Britain at one point. And the knowledge about colonization and enslavement and how they tend to go hand in hand, especially looking at the 1600s, the 1700s. And so she was doing it from that journalistic point. And somehow St. John's being the small, very interconnected city it is, our paths crossed it. And that led to Unearthed, which was the CBC podcast, the radio series about this subject matter. And then Boulder approached us a little bit after that had been out and asked us if we wanted to like put this information together with other things that we could find into a book.
Yeah. Wow. That's so exciting. I'm excited for you. First-hand sources for this. Did at any point come across documents from the 1600s, 1700s, things you got to sort of tangibly hold?
Not that I got to hold. So there's like from, I guess, the early 1800s, there's the uniform of this Black man, I guess the person who started all of this research, really, W.H., like we only can recognize him as W.H. So the rooms has his uniform and some other articles that like of clothing belonging to him, like shoes and maybe a knife, and things were inscribed with the initials W.H. and his bones as well are being, or his body and like his clothing fibers and like all of that is now being researched to find out more about him. So that's all encased, but we got to see it. And, you know, you got to visualize, you know, imagine the person who once wore this, you know, where they went, if they had any choice in where they were going, kind of thing. And then we spoke to people who had assessed wills and transcribed wills that from the 1700s, like written in Old English and pretty undecipherable. I mean, unless it's your area of specialty where you spend all day looking at this script and like this type of English, it's not something if you read a novel, like a 21st century novel, that you just like, oh, pick it up and be like, oh, I understand. So I didn't see that document itself, but like there are experts, spoke to experts who have gone through those documents and like, you know, transcribed it into English so that everybody can read it. So yeah, it was pretty cool seeing things from seriously a bygone era and being able to tell stories about it today in 2020, like the 2020s.
Yeah. I'm overwhelmed with, like, I think the sense of responsibility you probably felt, like, okay, this is a big story.
I would say there were moments where like, it is a big story, it's a lot. And I guess it's the first time anyone has like put it together in a book to be like, to try and offer people like, and just an introduction to some of the Black history of Newfoundland and Labrador. And I'm really grateful that I had Heather with me, who she was very much like, she's a seasoned producer and like host. So whereas my brain tends to go in like 1,000 different directions, and I feel this need that like we must try and grasp at like every straw and try and connect every single dot out there, it feels impossible, because it probably is impossible to complete put everything about any subject into one book, especially when it's the first time like something of this has been done. So definitely having her there like steering me, having like an outline, trying to like narrow down or focus into the lives of these people in this particular time and what we don't know about them and like what the history of slavery and like all of that has told us and what light it might shed about the Newfoundland context. So yeah.
Yeah, I imagine like Heather as a producer would be like, this is the story. Like, she would be good at narrowing.
She's very good at that. Yeah.
That is awesome.
I definitely, because especially like earlier on before the book took shape, like as it took its shape, it was much easier to like follow that pattern of like what you had like started out with. But especially like just diving in and where to start and how to start. And yeah, especially given the opportunity to turn something spoken into a written thing, you're like, oh, you can just write and write and write and write. But yeah, no, having some kind of direction is very, very useful.
When we talk about the history of slavery and its connection to Newfoundland and Labrador, did you uncover any historical surprises on this journey?
I guess, I would say what I was surprised about the most is, writing all of this down and doing all of this research. Mostly, like most people, I thought about, the very obvious connections. Like, I grew up eating salt cod in Jamaica, and I moved to Newfoundland, and it's like home of the salt cod, and it's like nothing crazy to anybody here to like have salt cod on their dinner plates or like any of their meals. So that connection, where it's been so talked about, everyone knows about it, that wasn't surprising to me. But it's like finding out about people who lived lives here, who were enslaved, who we don't know if they were born here or if they were brought here. And then finding out about ships that were made here that were later like used to become slave ships, and ships that dropped thousands of people in Jamaica. And so like we really explored, there's this database, the Slave Voyages database, and that like provides a lot of information about who were building ships, where the ships were built, what year, like how many times they went across the Atlantic, you know, how many people died on journeys. So seeing that and realizing that Newfoundland's connection to the slave trade and that period of slavery goes far beyond just, oh, the salt cod that was fished here was then fed to enslaved people in the Caribbean so that they could keep producing for the rest of the world. But knowing that, oh, some of the ships that also brought these people to the Caribbean and to different parts of the Americas were also like built in Newfoundland. And it's like, oh, the byproducts of what was being forced by these people to be produced in the Caribbean were also brought to Newfoundland and became staples. And so it's like, there's these layers of connection that I wasn't expecting. And it's not just like, oh, there weren't like plantation, there wasn't plantation slavery here, so that's the end of the story. But there's like other ways that Newfoundland has found itself entwined into this history of like the slave trade. The book is available in Newfoundland. Boulder Books it is their publisher, and you can get it on their website. You can also get it locally at Coleman's and Chapters. It's in store, so the Avalon Mall, Village Mall, and Chapters on Kenmount Road, as well as Piper's.
Yes,
and
look at Piper's.
You can like, there's like a little book section in Piper's. I don't know if it's every Piper's, but Piper's on Elizabeth, definitely. And Downtown Comics also is carrying it. So yeah, like a lot of places where you can get Boulder Books locally, you should be able to pick up a copy of Black Harbor.
And that is our first ever Riddle Fence podcast. A big thank you to my guests, Lisa Moore, Joshua Gowdy, and Xavier Michael Campbell. Thanks for coming and sharing your stories. Bye.